Okay, good afternoon. So today we're going to finish up talking about command injection and move on to talking about security with web browsers, which sort of has its own little specialized area with surprisingly many tricky things. So last time we were talking about command injection, which is this idea that we take user or attacker input and we wanted to embed it in some more complicated language like SQL or shell commands. And if we do this wrong, our input accidentally gets treated as commands in the language instead of part of a constant. And we have these defenses. So the best defense we had was just have an API where you don't need to put it in the language, where you can have some placeholder and specify the value separately in a way where there's no need to transform the value so it won't be misinterpreted. You just give a bunch of bytes to, say, the database, and it knows that that's a single value, it's not a SQL statement. Or you give a bunch of bytes to the operating system and it knows that's an argument that's not part of a shell command. And if you couldn't do that, the common things to do were whitelisting. You just say, these are inputs I know definitely won't be misinterpreted, or escaping. If you do it carefully and don't screw it up, most commonly by having multiple rounds of escaping that don't quite add up to the right thing. And we also talked briefly about sort of a detection technique to see if you messed up doing any of these, called taint tracking, where we look at, in a sort of code flow way, about where values go to see if, did you forget to sanitize a value in some way, either by passing it to the safe version of the API or by actually doing this whitelisting or filtering operation. So before we finish out this topic, I'd like to show you probably the most infamous command injection bug in recent memory, which is something called shell shock. Who heard of shell shock, which was like back in 2013 when it was a thing? Okay. So shell shock was a bug, a security bug in Bash, which is the most popular shell on Linux by a very wide margin. So Bash, like most shells, supports functions. So functions are probably not a feature you've ever used in your shell because you typically use a shell to run commands. But shells sort of are their own programming language. So you can define a function. And the function looks like this, and it can take arguments, which are put in this special variable $*, not very intuitive name, but that's what they use. And you can call the function like a command after you define it. So that's a reasonable feature for a programming language, convenient. You might imagine using this even on the command line. And Bash supports this, and it also supports a weird feature that most shells don't support called function exports. So they wanted it to be the case that you could define some functions in your shell and export them. And then when you run a new shell, those functions are still there, even though it's a new instance of the shell. So you needed some way to pass the functions from one copy of the shell to another. And their choice was to use environment variables, because passing it through the command line would be very awkward. Passing it through standard in wouldn't work, because you probably want to like type commands to that shell or give it a file or something like that. So they used environment variables for this. So if you defined a function foo and told Bash to export it, it would set the environment variable foo to this value, something starting with open and close parentheses, followed by the function definition. And when Bash started, it would look through all its environment variables for things starting with open and close parentheses and import all those functions. So let's say you're a lazy programmer programming Bash, and this is how you decided to implement passing functions from one copy of Bash to another. So you start a new copy of Bash, you read your environment variables, and you define all these functions that are specified this way, that someone exported from another copy of Bash that they started. So what's the easiest way of implementing this importing functionality? So this is how our function is defined, and this is what we're setting the environment variable to. What's the easiest thing to do? Yeah. Yeah, just generate this command and pass it to your run a command function. And this is in fact what Bash did. which turned out not to be the greatest choice. So that's exactly how Bash implemented this feature, that you could run a shell, define a function, say export all my functions, and then run another program that runs a shell, and it would have those functions again. And that happened because when that other inner shell started, it would actually run this on startup based on the environment variables. So that meant that, you know, if you had this environment foo set to this, it would run that. If you had foo set to this, it would run this. And that's where the problem started. So Bash had a way where if you set the environment variables, which aren't supposed to be a place where you put commands that get run, that you could run a command right now. Not just define some name for commands that you could use later, but you run commands right away. And this turned out to be a problem. Now, the non-obvious thing about this is you don't think of running shells as a sort of thing you do all the time, especially with environment variables being set. But the problem is that everyone uses the shell all the time. So when we talked about command injection as a problem, we were saying that to run like send mail, we ran a shell. We ran the shell just to run that one line of the command, but we didn't figure out how to divide it up into arguments ourselves. We passed it to the shell and had it do it. So this meant that any time any program was doing something like our send mail example, it would run the shell would read its environment variables, and if we accidentally had one set to the wrong value, it could possibly run a dangerous command like this. Yeah?
I don't understand how this is different than any of the other auto-start scripts in Linux.
So the question is, how is this different than auto-start scripts and such in Linux?
Anything that runs a command on startup isn't that
one? So how is this different than just running a command on startup? So when we run a command on startup, that's when we just start something up normally. But we run commands based on attacker input in different locations. So when we run commands on startup, the environment variables are just what they're set up to start on startup. When we're actually processing some input from, say, a web browser, we may have our environment variables set based on what the web browser does. What the web server got. So I'm going to give you a concrete example where this was exploitable, which I think will illustrate this better. So this is not going to be a web server case, so that was one of the cases. This is a case of a DHCP client. So DHCP is the protocol that your computer uses to set itself up on a network. So it connects to a network, it says, "Hello network, tell me how to configure myself." And the program which does that is called the DHCP client. So this program communicates with the network you just connected to. It says, give me the network settings. And setting network settings varies a whole lot. There's lots of ways of doing it. So people who write DHCP clients don't actually have the code to set the network settings in the DHCP client. Instead, they just run a program that's the person who installs the DHCP client, usually the manufacturer of the OS, like Linux distribution, like Ubuntu or Red Hat would configure, some program that takes the network settings it got from the network and sets them up. And that program is usually written as a shell script. And we want to pass what the network settings are to the program. And the easiest, nice, clean way to do it that they chose to do is through environment variables. So the way a typical DHCP client would work on Linux, say, it would connect to your network, it would figure out what the network settings are, it would put them in environment variables, and run this script which would know how to configure your network card and all that stuff. So something you could do if you control the network that people were connecting to is you could say, okay, my network, it has a special domain name. Its domain name is open parentheses, close parentheses, open brace, semicolon, close brace, semicolon, and some command. And when the DHCP client was running this script to configure all our network settings, it would pass the domain name to it by setting an environment variable to that string from the network. That was supposed to be safe because it's just an environment variable. It's just a string that the shell program can read and put in our network setting somewhere. And yeah, that's not a valid domain name, but it shouldn't be harmful to have an invalid domain name. It should just mean our network connection's broken. But what actually happens is that when we run this script that does the get our network connection set up, it runs bash to run that script. Bash looks at this environment variable, says, oh, I need to define a domain name function for you. So I'm going to run this piece of shell here, and it runs this command. And even more disturbingly, this is run with privileges to be able to configure network devices, which means it usually can do lots of dangerous things. So this is an example where this was a really big problem, and there were lots of situations like this, where somewhere someone was writing a shell script where they assumed that it wouldn't matter that they were passing some unsanitized info in an environment variable, because who expects environment variables to be run as commands? So this is why this was a big deal. So this is one example of an actual exploitable case, but there were tons. All because Bash did this unexpected thing. Yeah.
Is this why it's all the file then? Instead of it was the workaround that does not use environment variables to pass it instead of writing.
So the question is, what was the workaround fixed for this bug? So that's a more complicated story. So the first thing Bash did when fixing this bug is they made their command parser have a mode where it would parse a function definition and stop. And that seemed great. Seemed like it solved the problem. And, well, it fixed this problem. This wouldn't work anymore. But it wasn't actually a full solution, because it turns out that the Bash command parser is not something you should put attacker input in front of. So when someone ran, well, I think exactly the program we have you using for fuzz against Bash, they discovered that there were lots of ways of crashing it by just having something in the middle of this function definition here. So it was still exploitable, because the Bash command parser was not designed to deal with all the sorts of funny input you could give it. I think some of the more paranoid distributions eventually just turned off this feature in Bash, because it's not actually very commonly used. Or at least turn it off by default. But yeah. But the initial fix was actually to make it so you could do this parsing and have dangerous command be ignored. So any other questions about this example? Okay. So that's our last sort of pure command injection thing. But I'm going to go to one more example of command injection that has to do with the web. So the other most famous and most dangerous category of command injection has its own name, cross-site scripting. So this is just command injection where command language is not shell or SQL, but HTML. Sort of the classic example of what this might look like is maybe I have a comment form on my website, and you can enter this in, and if I did things wrong, this will inject this script tag, and the script tag will cause my browser to run JavaScript when it loads this page if that ends up in my web page after I submit this form. So this is probably the most commonly noticed form of command injection these days. It's not as obviously dangerous as sort of our first example where you're running whole shell commands, but it turns out that it's going to be pretty bad. So we're going to talk a lot today about how web security works based on what the web browser might do based on things like this command injection, and what websites need to do to keep themselves safe. And this is going to go beyond keeping this sort of command injection from happening. So the interesting thing about the web from a security perspective is that your web browser talks to multiple parties. So your web browser, you know, talks to Facebook, might talk to some website which uses Facebook login, so it needs to talk to Facebook and that website in some cooperative way. And also, you visit websites you don't actually trust. And you expect your web browser to not send everything you're sending to Facebook also to, you know, evil.com. So your web browser has a pretty hard job here to mediate communication between all these parties. And one way of looking at it is the web browser is basically a multi-user operating system. So every website can have JavaScript. It has this full programming language. So websites are basically just JavaScript programs as far as the web browser is concerned. Websites can communicate with each other. So they can, you can have a widget, for, like a Twitter widget embedded on some other website. You can have websites where you submit a form on one website and it goes to another. So there's ways for websites to talk to each other. And the web browser is responsible for coordinating that. And websites can store data on the browser. They have the analogy of a file system. In the browser, it doesn't look like a file system, but it lets them store data kind of like a file system does. And the web browser is responsible for managing permissions on that file system and storage limits and all that sort of thing. So I'm going to give a basic overview of what the web browser does. I don't know how familiar people are with HTTP and things like that. So the basic way the web works is that when you have a URL like this that says to send a request that says that is at server.com, that's the server it's at, and there's this path here and other stuff. And this request says that the browser should connect to server.com, and the browser is going to send the rest of the URL, besides the server name, to that server, in addition to some other information. So there's several parts of this that we can talk about. So the first thing is we have this sort of command in HTTP. So this is the command that's sent to the server. And the two most common commands are get and post. So get basically means read a web page. Post means submit a form, basically. There are more. These are the most important ones. In addition to the URL, the web browser can send headers. And these are sort of key value pairs that are extra information supplied with the request. There's one mandatory header, which is host, to say what server name did you use to find me. Everything else is basically optional, and you'll see varying amounts actually used. Okay. So after the browser sends this, the server sends back what is called an HTTP response. So the response starts with a version number and what is called a status code, which is usually 200 for OK, and there's others for other types of things, 404 for not found, a whole bunch of others, and also another list of key value pairs, followed by the actual content being sent, usually like the web page. And you can explore this yourself. So pretty much every browser out there has a way of getting at what your HTTP requests look like. So in Firefox, this is developer tools. There's something similar in Chrome, and I'm pretty sure in Edge and Opera and probably any other web browser you might possibly be using. So I go to this, and I go to network. And if I reload this web page here, I see a list of all the HTTP requests that were made by my browser. So something you'll notice that is very common is that web pages don't just involve one request. There's multiple files involved. So here, here I have a request for the main web page, a request for things related to this embedded calendar here. I have requests for images. Maybe some could have requests for images, probably cached. So, but here's the main request, the request for the main web page, the main piece of HTML. And you can see that my browser tells me here are all the request headers I sent. Gives me the whole list. See the host header and all the others. And here are all the response headers the server sent back. And we can also see in a separate tab here a list the actual content of the response. And we can view this not just for that request, but for every other request. So you can see the request for the main.css, which is a file that this web page required, and so on. So you can see what happens yourself on any web page. Yeah?
If you interact with the website through curl or something else, does that send all these headers for you?
So the question is, when you use some library like curl that knows how to talk to websites, does it send all these headers for you? So it sends some of these headers, at least. As I said, most of these headers are optional. Most of the request headers here. Only the host one is really required. And sometimes not even that. Okay. So that's brief demo. So HTML also supports what forms. So forms are where you fill in something on a website, you click submit, and it gets sent to the web server. And that works in one of basically two ways. So one way is that forms, we can specify here's an input to use. Inputs, some of these inputs are visible. So here we have search for and an input named Q with an empty value. That will show up as a box because it doesn't have a type. The one with a type hidden doesn't show up as anything. That's what we saw you used earlier to pass something to form mail. And type submit will show up as a submit button. And when the web browser submits this form, it's going to, in this case, because it says method equals get, it's going to turn it into a get command to the web server. So it takes the action we specified, adds a question mark, and an encoding of all the form parameters we used. So Q equals, and in this case, what I searched for with some funny encoding for the spaces. And there's another style of forms which use posts, which are for things which are not supposed to be cached, but it's the same idea. We specify the method as post, we specify a URL, and we send the post command to the web server specified in that URL with the rest of the URL from there as the first line of the command, along with, in the content part, after all the headers, those key value pairs, an encoding of all the parameters we have in our form. So this is what forms do. They just get churned into the browser into these HTTP requests. And the web server is responsible for doing something useful with that, like sending a message to someone or adding to a comment page. So a very simple issue that comes up when people don't quite understand how this works is issues with trusting the client. So this is even simpler than command injection. And let's go back to our form mail example from last time. So last time we were worried about what if someone put something that's not really an email in this webmaster at example.com. And that was the main concern in 1995. These days, your main concern is, what if someone puts the address of someone they want to spam in there? Because this is going to happen if you put this form up on the web. Guaranteed. Even if you don't know command injection problems, they'll just put different email addresses and send people spam. So can I get with this form? So this is my form. I have webmaster@example.com hard coded. So can I get a recipient of spamtarget@foo.com? Is that something I should expect on my web server? So we said this is what the browser does to this. It looks through each input, puts it in the request. So if I'm running a web server, and this is my form, should I expect to get messages where the recipient isn't webmaster@example.com? Or could I? So you're nodding. Can someone explain how? Yeah. You have an explanation? No. You?
theoretically there shouldn't be a way, but because you can like inspect element and change the HTML, you can just change the value and then send the form.
Yeah, so those developer tools I showed you earlier, we could just change the form. So I can go into inspector here. I believe I can, let's just go into content, find right here. I can't easily quickly do this without looking, but I can, here we are. So I can just edit. You can edit here with, just hard. So I can, say I don't like this, that title there, and say, worse, I can deface the web page in my browser. That is something I am allowed to do. See? And I could also deface the form fields, because it's my browser. It's not yours, it's not the web server software, it's my software. I can make it do what I want. I have this functionality. So it doesn't matter that I hard-coded it there, someone can change it, tell their browser it changed, and have their browser use that changed value. Because it's the client, it's their software, they get to decide what it does, not me operating the web server. Yeah. So this means, the attacker can change the form, and they can even change it without changing the URL displayed in their web browser, which gets rid of probably the most common thought for how we avoid this problem, which is checking what is called the referrer header, and yes, that's misspelled. And it is deliberately misspelled because that is how it is spelled in the standard. So web browsers will sometimes send this referrer header, which says, where was the form that I filled out? Where did I get it from? But it doesn't matter that they're sending that because I modified the form at this without changing the URL the web browser was at. It's going to send the right one. You can't check that. I control the browser. So there's this fundamental separation that if you're making a website, you can't trust anything the browser is sending. Everything in here that the browser generates from the form, you can't trust that. Someone can change their browser to send whatever they want. And if that's useful to them, you need to handle that. This seems like a relatively simple lesson that people would at least, get right if they did their research. But that turned out not to be the case. So here's a mailing list post from 2000 saying that many web-based shopping cart applications use hidden fields in HTML forms to hold parameters for items in an online store. These parameters can include things like the price. And these people are bragging in their press release that they've identified 11 shopping cart applications that do this. The question is, are they still around? Probably not. But it's not unheard of for people to make this mistake. Because our models, this shouldn't happen. But you can, but people don't think that the browser is a mutable thing that you don't really control as a web server. And assume that because it's a hidden field, you can't change it. Maybe at least if I'm checking the referrer, so I know it's on the right website. It's not true. Yeah. So in this case, you could add something to your shopping cart after changing the price parameter, and it would show up in your shopping cart as having a different price. Then you could click purchase, and it would purchase it as if it had a different price. And if someone processed that order without checking the price, they would sell it to you for the wrong price. If you're the attacker, presumably, yes. Okay. So you could also do other things like make up new items, probably, and things like that, but probably less useful because when they process the order, they probably won't give it to you. But you could probably lower the price and they won't check, right? if you get a printed out order where the price is off by 20%, you probably won't notice. You're just shipping them out. So that's our separation between web browsers and web servers. So web browsers send these requests for each web page, and generating one web page might require requesting multiple files. Each file is its own request. And they're kind of tied together in that we request them all together. So we saw I got our course website, and that made lots of requests for individual files. But those are individual, separate requests. They aren't actually directly connected in any way. Each one of them is just saying, give me this file, and the server responds, here's this file. There's no connection between them. And we call this stateless. So HTTP doesn't have state. When we make a request, it stands by itself. We can look at that request in isolation, and we can figure out how the server should respond to it. The server doesn't have context by default. In practice, we do. We log into a website, and things happen based on us being logged in. That's all bolted on. Sort of HTTP by itself doesn't handle any of this. So all that functionality was added later, and it kind of shows in how it works that it was added later. It's a little awkward. So there's no idea of what we often call a session, that where did I come from when I'm requesting this form? What, you know, am I logged in or not? That's not actually part of those HTTP commands. We just get something or post something. So obviously, on real websites, we do have logins. And that has to be implemented somehow. And there's a common extension to HTTP, which pretty much every browser implements, that's used to do this, called cookies. And cookies are a way of sort of getting this state that we didn't have. So we don't have any connection between requests originally, so cookies are a way of adding that back. And the idea of a cookie is that the server is going to send us a little bit of information. And the client's going to send it back with every request. So now the server can know, oh, these requests are related to each other. So it can know that, say, they all come from this user who I just let log in. And that's how the server can figure out things like, oh, are you allowed to read this file on Facebook? Yes, because you're logged in. Or no, because I haven't seen you log in yet. So the mechanism is actually very simple. The server sends this header in its HTTP response with some value, some info, that the server gets to choose. The client doesn't understand what it means. The client doesn't need to know. And also some extra information to tell the client how to use it. But the important part is it sends a little bit of info, and the client sends it back in the future. So you log in, the server sends you this cookie, then you click a link after you're logged in, the client sends back this cookie, the server knows, oh, I just logged you in because I sent this cookie when I logged you in. So I know it's still you. So any questions about this cookie mechanism? We'll look at some little examples, but. Okay, so the question is, how do we implement timed logins, given this mechanism? So there's going to be two ways we can do it. So one way doesn't require any extra information. One way is we just send a cookie, and on the server we remember, when did we send it last? And we look that up when you get it back, and say, has it been too long? And if it has, we say, your login's not valid. So that's one way of doing it. Another way is that there is a little extra information sent with these cookies. You see this expires here. So we can actually say, hey, web browser, I want you to forget about this in an hour or a week or something like that. I think the best practice is probably to do both. To both check on the server, when did I last send it? Is this as long as I want logins to last? And also to tell the web browser, please forget about it when you don't need it anymore. You want to do it on the server because the client might remember for longer because you don't control it. You can tell it, please forget about it. It doesn't have to do that. You can also tell it to please remember, and it doesn't have to do that either. So you probably want to do both. So cookies, as I said, the most important thing is that they contain whatever the server wants them to contain. The most frequent choice, but it's just a choice, is that the server makes up a number called a session ID, which identifies which login, which session, which time accessing the website this is. Some unique number, usually a random number, so people can't guess it, so people can't send a cookie and pretend to be logged in. And they send that once, and they just keep sending that for the entire session, and everything else is tracked on the server. So they remember the session ID, and then they look up in a database whether this session has logged in or not, whether they've seen that before. So you could also store information in cookies that's more descriptive, like you could store who they're logged in as. This has some problems because you have all the same issues as hidden fields. So typically, websites don't do that, and I do not recommend doing that. But there are safe ways to do it. They are not obvious. Yeah? So the question is, could you use hashes to do this safely? So you basically need to use some form of cryptography. Hashes probably aren't quite the right description of what you'd use, but something similar to that. I think it's worth it because you can screw up the cryptography. It's actually much harder to screw up just sending a random number. And you probably need to look things up in the database anyways, and that's all you're saving by not sending a random number. So this is typically how cookies are used. So our web browser sort of logging in will have this exchange of multiple requests to log in and actually get our website. So if I'm logging into foo.com here, our web browser is first going to send a command to get the login page. So it's going to get the login page, and the web server is going to send back, oh, here's a cookie for you to use, and here's the login form that you should fill out. Then we type into the login form, and our web browser generates the post command for the login form. We're filling out the form, and we send back that cookie we just got sent with the form, along with what we filled in. And now the foo.com can remember, oh, okay, your user silly nickname 42, hopefully it actually checks this password. Okay, you logged in successfully. I'm going to remember in my database that session ID 12345678 is logged in as this username. So I'm going to remember that for the future. And I'm going to tell you, okay, you're logged in. Why don't you go to front page? So we say, please go to front page. Then the web browser sends a GET request for the front page and sends again the value in the cookie. And remember that we don't actually know at the web server, except for this cookie, that this user is logged in. But because we see this cookie here with this session ID that we just remembered is logged in, we know, okay, you're logged in. I'm going to give you the front page for you, not some generic version of it. So this is typically how logins are implemented. And you see that we have this statelessness going on. So if we want to remember something like that you're logged in, we need to have it be sent back every single time by the browser. There's otherwise not a way we're going to know this is the same user who just logged in. Any questions about this exchange? Yeah. So the question is, does the cookie need to be sent all the way up here, or could we only send it when they're logged in? And both are valid options. It's probably usually easier to implement sending it when you send the login page and just always have a session ID, but you don't have to do that. Okay, so we have this extra thing called cookies that are very important. And now we're going to go back to our command injection problem. So when I showed you an example of cross-site scripting, that's command injection into HTML, I was just doing something mildly annoying. I was saying, let's redirect to attacker.com. Yeah.
One more question on the cookies thing. It's using a random number generally, so it's potentially generating the same number for three different people.
Okay, so the question is, how do we make this session ID be generated correctly? So the best practice is to generate a large random number, then look it up in a database, see if you already have one, and if you do, generate another one, and also say your random number generator is broken. So you can avoid duplicates that way, because you're storing this in a database anyways, because you need to remember this login. So as I was saying, we're looking at, we gave our silly example of command injection here, where I was running JavaScript, which happens to just change where the web browser is. So this redirects you to attacker.com. So it's kind of vandalism. That's sort of the easy thing to do with cross-site scripting injection into HTML. You know, so that seems annoying, something you don't want to happen on your website, but it doesn't actually seem like really dangerous. But cookies are an example where we can be really dangerous. So cookies are accessible to JavaScript on the website that they're sent from. So we can do some in our cross-site scripting, I can enter as my comment this piece of JavaScript here, where I generate a new image in JavaScript and say the image is on evil.com and it happens to contain the value of the cookie in its URL. And what this is going to do is going to cause my web browser to say, oh, I need to load an image. I'm going to go to send a get command to evil.com with the value of the cookie, which has my session ID. And if you remember how this works here, we sent this cookie here, and it's equivalent to sending the username and password. Because when we see that cookie, we remember they logged in, they're that user, so it's equivalent to the username and password. So we're basically doing the same thing as retrieving your username and password this way. And I, as the operator of evil.com, can read my web server's logs and figure out, okay, this is the session ID I can use right now. I can just go to foo.com and start reading people's stuff. I can just make my browser send that cookie, because I control my browser. I can make it send whatever cookies I want, and I can read everyone else's stuff. So it's really bad. And this is why people are really concerned about cross-site scripting. You don't just vandalize a web page. You end up getting full access to everything everyone logged in has. Yeah. So in our example, we were posting a comment. So in this example, the hypothetical would be this comment is going to be displayed on the web page to anyone who visits it. So we're going to hope that someone who's logged in, who's not me, visits it, reads my comment, and by reading my comment, sends me their equivalent to the password, and I can use that to read the website as them. Yeah. So the question is, would this work only if it automatically lists all the comments, or if you have to like click to load each one? So if it's not loaded, it probably doesn't work until you load it, because it has to get this HTML there. Though often the way websites would implement click to load is that they'd load everything and just hide it, in which case this would still be part of the HTML and still be running. Yeah, so the question is, it could be not visible. Yeah, it absolutely could be not visible on the web page anywhere. It just has to be in the HTML the browser is trying to process. The browser is going to run the scripts it finds. So quite often, it would be completely invisible. Yes?
Couldn't you
Okay, so question is, isn't a solution to this to bind session IDs to IP addresses? So this is an often proposed solution, and I don't teach network security. I'm trying to separate this class from that. But the complicated story in network security is that IP addresses are not secure identifiers, that there are ways of spoofing IP addresses. How you do that is not something we're likely to have time to talk about, especially because I'd have to make networking a prereq to really explain it. But there are ways of effectively spoofing IP addresses. So that's not actually a principled secure choice, though it is a mitigation which makes it harder. The other problem with it is that people often change IP addresses while they're visiting your website. So this proposal will break your website for legitimate users. So an example is, I take my laptop here, I'm logged into a website, I plug in my office, might have a different IP address then. I go home, I have a different IP address. And often you still want your login to work despite that. And there's other reasons like firewalls and things like that, finding networking configurations which cause people to change IP addresses all the time. So most websites don't tightly bind to IP address without being careful about things like that because it's annoying to their users. But even if they did, it doesn't actually solve the security problem, which just makes it a bit harder for the attacker. But in general, there are ways of using the same IP address. Also, we'll talk later on about other things you can do with cross-site scripting when you don't have the cookie values, which are about as bad. Okay. So other questions about our sort of cross-site scripting for cookies example? Okay. So this was an example of, our hypothetical example is that we have a form, we post a comment, our comment appears in the form, it has some HTML in it which runs this code that gets our cookie, so the attacker can pretend to be everyone who reads it. So this is the simplest form of cross-site scripting, this command injection into HTML. It's actually not the most common. So most of the time, we don't have some way we can store something on a website, like it's something with like a shopping cart. We can't store something there typically. We can't add new items as to to the list of products. We often don't have those permissions. So the most common form of cross-site scripting is what's called reflected cross-site scripting, where we send a request, a single request, and we get back something in the HTML in that. But it's not something which is stored on the website, so if someone else visits it, they'll just see it. This is much more common. It's a much more common mistake. People are usually careful when they have comment forms, if only because sometimes someone's going to enter a greater than sign and it's going to mess up the display. And they'll realize, I should filter this field. But it's more common to have this problem with things like hidden values, which happen more often on forms which aren't things we just display to every user. So I'll give an example of a real cross-site scripting bug. This is in WordPress, which is some blog software, which was commonly used, still is, version 1.2.1. So this is their PHP code. It generates this input field, a hidden input field, whose value is this PHP code here, which is just copying the value of a form input, but without doing any filtering. So we can pass something like this, and just like our old command injection example, we're going to have this script tag be interpreted as HTML, as commands, instead of as the value of this hidden input in the form that we're outputting. And the intention of this is that this was a login form, basically. So you generate the website to go to afterwards, and you get that from whatever link got you to the login form. So your login links would look like this, where foo would be replaced by the place that you should go back to after you log in. So if I, as an attacker, know that this flaw exists, how can I exploit this to get someone else's credentials? Yeah. So you're saying you should, so that's a, different issue. So you're saying you want to fool them to think your website is their website. So that's something that's phishing, that's a valid attack. We're not going to talk about that particular attack. But let's say they can figure out what website they're on reliably. So we can actually do this even if people can figure out what website they're on reliably, if they're doing everything right with respect to the advice we give users about check what website you're on, look at the URL bar. Common advice we give to prevent the sort of click a link in your email and enter your password to an attacker sorts of things. So even if you follow that advice, given this flaw, this is a problem, we can still pretend to be that user. We can do this attack. So how can we get this attack done not on us, but on some other user? So what's our setup going to be? And you have the right idea about tricking them to go to a website. But let's say they're going to know it's our website. What do we do? Yeah?
So you send them a link that has that login, and you replace foo with your malicious code from the bottom?
Yeah, so we can just send them our malicious link. Tell them to click it. And it doesn't matter that they're going to notice something isn't right because it's too late. Once they've clicked this link, we have their cookie. We can log in as them. And we can even be more subtle than that. No. So we could just give them the link, hope they click on it. But we can be way, way more subtle. So remember, like on our course webpage, we have a Google Calendar embedded on it. That uses something called an iframe, which is a way that you can say in HTML, I'd like to embed another webpage here. So you can do that with our malicious link. You can have an iframe, and you can put it all the way at the bottom of your webpage and make it invisible. It will still be loaded. And when it's loaded, it runs this, our malicious JavaScript here, and steals the cookie. So there's nothing visible to the user. They just visit evil.com, and all of a sudden we have a copy of their cookie for example.com. And we can do other versions of it, like we can make a form, and we can have JavaScript submit the form for that. They just visit evil.com, it has this JavaScript, they're going to submit that form, they're going to run that JavaScript code on example.com. They're just going to send us a copy of the cookie. Yeah?
So, you think example.com is like a good respective website, would you do some other attack to get this code at the bottom? Or do you mean like example.com is your website?
So this is on my website, which is not respected. And I just put this code on there and convince someone who has an account on example.com to visit it. How I do that, there's various ways. Like I could send them a link in their email. I could just, if example.com was a popular website, I could just say it's popular enough, I'm just going to put it on my website and I'm going to get lucky. But we just need any way for people to visit a website with this code, because any website can do this. Yeah.
Facebook embedded in the bottom.
Yeah. So that if we had this, if our vulnerable website was Facebook, we do this for Facebook. And then we'd assume that some large portion of the people visiting our website would have a Facebook account and be logged in, and this would get us their information. Yeah.
So this vulnerability is with example.com
and
not with JavaScript or WordPress?
Yes. There's an argument to be made either way. The vulnerability, that the place we're going to fix it is by fixing example.com. The way it works is because our web browser is going to trust the JavaScript that it gets back from example.com is right, and it's going to let it read the cookie and send it off to evil.com or wherever. So this sort of vulnerability, you see, exists in such an exploitable way because we can just embed web pages in other web pages. Yeah.
So I know that when I look at my cookies, they all know what website they're from.
Yeah.
So why does it not only send back cookies to the website that they're from? Or is this kind of like that?
So we are
Facebook widget in here or whatever other website problem.
So here, yeah, so the question is, why doesn't the cookie only get sent to the right website?
Yeah.
And it does. And this is exactly as you said, you have sort of a Facebook widget in another website. If we have like a Google Calendar widget, like on our course webpage, that knows it belongs to google.com. And that sends Google cookies. And the same thing is happening here. Here, we've embedded an example.com widget. One that example.com didn't intend to have, but it's a widget nonetheless. And it's going to send cookies for example.com. It's going to let the JavaScript access things for example.com because it's coming from example.com. So it looks completely legitimate. That's the sort of cookies it should have. It shouldn't have evil.com's cookies. It should have example.com's cookies. So you can think of sort of the root cause of this problem being this idea that we let websites talk to other websites all the time. And maybe we shouldn't be doing that, but it's everywhere. Like, you can't go to a major website and not see things loaded from 20 different websites all at the same time, each one with its own cookies and its own JavaScript that needs to run. And somehow this needs to not let one website make another send things to the wrong place. It's just that concept earlier I mentioned that browsers are kind of like an OS. Making all these websites be separate from each other, which are like separate programs. They're keeping them isolated from each other, but still letting them communicate in controlled ways. So, and the vulnerability here and the subtle thing is that the problem is when we can put anything on the vulnerable website, because anything at example.com can read that cookie and give it away. So if we ever serve anything from example.com with malicious JavaScript, we've lost if we operate example.com. Doesn't matter where. So here we have this vulnerable login form, let's say. That's enough because our attacker can direct someone to that. It doesn't matter that it's not a normal page on our website. It doesn't matter that we never generate this link ourselves. The attacker can still make the user go there and and run this command injection bug in the browser and make the browser give away the cookie that it's supposed to keep private to example.com. Because it looks like to the browser that example.com said, hey, it's safe, give this cookie away. Which, unfortunately, is sometimes maybe something a website would want to do. Sometimes they'd want to give another website their cookie or something like that. So the browser can't actually know that anything's wrong. So, and this is really annoying when you're making websites. So one annoyance is that you need to make sure you don't do things like this. That you sanitize everything. Doesn't matter if it's something that the user can't change, like this redirect to link, which is set by your software because it comes from the browser. This is that trusting the client issue. That's why people have trouble finding these cross-site scripting bugs, is because they don't think of them as things the user enters, but they actually do come from the browser. They're things not controlled by the website. And it's particularly pernicious in some more subtle cases when you want to let people upload user content. So if I upload user content, like if you let me upload an HTML file, I can get the cookies for your website. Doesn't matter where that HTML file is. And this even occurs sometimes, historically, with other things. So let's say you allow users to upload profile pictures. Well, here's my profile picture. It might not display in your image viewer because it's not an image file, but I'm going to call it an image file and send it to your website. See if you check. And then I'm just going to put a link to that as an iframe on some other website and see what happens. So if you serve this image file from this link, then you're out of luck. This is another example of cross-site scripting where you don't even think you're serving HTML. So fortunately, HTTP has what should be a mitigation for this. So in those headers, you're supposed to send, and most people remember to, because your website usually breaks if you don't, a content type. So for example, we say text HTML to say it's HTML. We say image PNG to say this is an image. Please do not interpret it as something else. And this should prevent this problem, so long as this program here, this get picture, whatever's doing that, actually remembers to send that. It doesn't make the browser guess what it is, because the browser's going to look at this and say, oh, it's HTML. I'll help you with that. So you have to tell it it's PNG. It's not HTML. You shouldn't run the JavaScript in there. It's not. Please don't. So you'd think that if you were sending content type image PNG or something like that, you'd be safe. And these days, you probably are, but historically, you weren't. This is really surprising. So the story is, some web servers always sent the wrong content type. And web browsers aren't going to deal with, oh, my web browser is broken. Yeah, because when I go to this website, it doesn't display anything correctly. So web browsers decided, some of them, to compensate for this. So they said, oh, you're sending the wrong content type all the time? I'm going to auto-detect the content types to fix this problem for you. So until version 8, Internet Explorer would say, oh, image PNG? I'm going to look at the file myself and double-check. Just to make sure. Oh, it looks like HTML, I'm going to interpret it as HTML for you. Just don't worry, you know, it doesn't matter that your web server is misconfigured, apparently. And many browsers today, even, if you serve something as text plain, they'll interpret it as HTML if it's served in a certain way, because there's a certain set of broken web servers which do this that they want to work with. Yeah? The widget problem, as in this problem?
Where you can, not for uploads, but where you were talking about how you could have like a hidden.
So like where we had our redirect to here and we just made it a widget? No. Because if it's HTML, it's HTML. That's what a widget is. What an embedded web page is, it's HTML, it's the right type. Yeah.
Couldn't a browser just have like an unsecure warning? If they have to change, like they could still change the text type to display the website so that it doesn't break, but then have a warning to like tell the users that it might be unsafe and also get people to fix their website.
Okay, so the question is, couldn't the browser just display a warning? So there's some research on the effectiveness of warnings like this, and the answer is basically no. They could, but it wouldn't do anything because people would ignore the warning.
I mean, when Chrome puts up like that big, do you want to proceed?
Oh, so they could display a real warning, like the really hard to get out of warning. Yes, they could do that. That would be an option. They could also do something like display the HTML, but don't run any scripts. That'd be another option. I don't know if they've done this. There's not many. They're very limited in when they do this now. But before Internet Explorer 8, this was actually a huge problem. Other questions? No. Okay. So we've started seeing several examples of cross-site scripting. And we know our normal mitigations for cross-site scripting are when you have code like this, don't do this. Like, put this through something else before you echo it. Like, that's the sort of standard right thing to do. There are some other mitigations that are specific to cross-site scripting that aren't just our general sanitize your input stuff that we can do to help out here. So one thing that web browsers can do, web browsers don't want to have cross-site scripting happen. They want some way of preventing this. And one thing you can do is you can try to guess if you have a cross-site scripting attack happen. So IE8 implemented this feature where they looked to see if HTML from the request appeared exactly in the response in a way which looked like it was probably cross-site scripting. And if so, they would not run the scripts there, not run that piece of HTML. And this isn't a reasonable idea, but it's a bit tricky because you could put something in your form which is supposed to be there. You know, there's some HTML that's supposed to be on the website, and you could absolutely enter that into a form, legitimately. So this is kind of risky, but this is an idea that people have tried, which probably helps in some of the simpler scenarios. So if we're talking about sort of the issues of content type guessing and things like that, this is something where a mitigation is to just use a different domain for the dangerous stuff. So for example, Google and GitHub host uploaded content on a different domain name. This domain name doesn't have access to the Google cookies or the GitHub cookies. So they don't have to worry about what crazy things the web browser is doing about misinterpreting things that are served as PNG files, because it can't get at the cookies anyways, because it's not the same domain name. This is not a very cheap mitigation, because you need to register a new domain name, but it's sort of the gold standard. You're not going to get into problems, you know, even if you screw a whole bunch of things up. Like, you probably are trying to do all the sanitization and MIME type stuff right, but even if you don't, you're not going to get in too much trouble this way for uploaded content, which is the most dangerous thing for this, because it's hardest to, like, let someone upload an HTML page and display it without running scripts. Like, that's tricky to do. If you saw the examples where we got escaping wrong with commands, like, HTML has similar problems where you might not know how browsers will interpret things, and you need to get the escape thing exactly right, or else you're in big trouble. Okay, so these are sort of heuristic mitigations. There's also a major thing that feature that browsers support to help websites avoid this problem called content security policy. So this is an HTTP header, which websites can send to browsers, where they can say, what sorts of things should you load on this website? So you can say, for example, with this content security policy, please only load things that come from the same host or are embedded literally as text in the web page. Only run scripts, only load images, only load iframes, things like that, only from the same host or if they're literally in the web page, in the web page's text. So this means that when we try to load that image from ewl.com, which is named after our cookie, it's not going to work because it's not from the same host. And it's not literally in the text of the web page, it's on ewl.com. So this makes it really hard to pull off a useful cross-site scripting attack. So maybe we embed something in the web page, but it doesn't do anything. And we can also set sort of more strict policies like, hey, just don't run any scripts on this file. Like, this is HTML, but don't run any scripts whatsoever, don't run any plugins, don't run any style sheets, or only run style sheets that are in external files. We can actually say that sort of strict policy about some file that we're serving that we don't have sanitized correctly. So the worst that the attacker can do is make the HTML look weird. They can't actually send the cookie away to another server. So questions about this idea? So I guess some minor things. So you notice that I have style sheets listed here. So why would we care about style sheets? So style sheets are the CSS. Who's used CSS before? Like, 30 of the people. So this is another language you embed in HTML to specify sort of how you display your document. And just like HTML, it has command injection problems. And non-obviously, you can give away parts of the HTML by breaking CSS. The sort of attack, which is not very obvious, is that you make the browser think some part of the web page is part of CSS, part of inline CSS, and it then sends that part of the web page like as a background image URL. So, but that's why this is included here. But content security policy just lets you exhaustively specify what things can my website contact. So you can just say, there's no way to load anything from evil.com. There's no way you could be giving away information. And you can be more selective. So you might see real policies like this, where you say, load scripts from my website and some other website I trust, but not any other websites. So from Google Analytics might be common. And you can sort of whitelist what you need as you go. So sort of the recommended thing that people are supposed to do with content security policy is you start with a policy kind of like this. You say, first, don't let me load anything from anywhere. And then you just list all the things you actually need. And if you do this right, this means that the most that anyone who actually does a cross-site scripting attack can do is not going to be very much more than your website is supposed to be able to do. Now, this should make it a lot less bad if someone finds a cross-site scripting problem. Yes?
Is this security policy set by the web server or by the...
The question is, who sets this policy? Is it the web server? Is it the web user? So this is a header sent to browsers. So the web server sends this header, and that determines the policy. So you send it with every web page, what policy you want to apply. So you, as a website administrator, would configure your web server to send the header you want. Yeah?
How does this stop the example from before
where you don't want
evil.com and it takes a
guess?
What is the...
Okay, so the question is, given that we've, set this policy, what's going to happen when, we do this? So we're going to load this thing from example.com in a sub-window. And it's going to have this JavaScript in it. So then we're going to apply that policy. And it's going to say, let's say it says you can run JavaScript. That's in the web page. So we're going to run this JavaScript. And this JavaScript's going to try to fetch an image from this location. We're going to look at the policy. It's going to say, you can fetch images from example.com, and that's it. And we're not going to fetch this image. So that's where the attack would fail in that case. So either it would fail because the policy says you can't run scripts at all, or it would fail because the policy says you can't fetch images from evil.com. So that would be where we'd stop it. So there's probably still some annoying things we can do, possibly security-breaking things we can do, but we've stopped all the most obvious ways of getting information away. So other questions about content security policy? But this is less than optimal because we're still maybe, if we want to run scripts on our website, we're still running scripts in this case because our policy is going to let us do that. So content security policy actually supports lots of features. So we can actually set a policy which does a bit better than that. So one feature they support is nonces for scripts. So not only can you say, you can say run scripts on the website or don't run scripts on the website. You can also say run embedded scripts if they're marked with what's called a nonce. Nonce stands for number used only once. The idea is that every time the server generates the web page, it generates this unique code here and puts it on every legitimate script. So every script that is supposed to be in the web page. And it changes every time you load the web page. So the attacker, when they generate their illegitimate script their illegitimate script here, they can't put that in there. They don't have the correct value. So this is sort of a feature which lets you have embedded scripts and not let people embed them with cross-site scripting, assuming that you actually use this number only once and don't make it guessable. Questions about these nonces here? This is sort of the midway between allow all scripts on the web page and don't. You can allow selectively, based on making sure it's probably only the ones that you put there, because you generated the nonce and this nonce and change it every time you fetch the web page. So another mitigation, besides content security policies, tries to attack getting at the cookies. So the cookies are a usual target for the attacker because they let us pretend to be a login user. And you might say, why does JavaScript need to have access to these cookies? It's a good question, and usually it doesn't. Sometimes it does. Sometimes people do that in their website. Like, they'll put not like a session ID, but they'll put some other information in a cookie that JavaScript needs to have. But often, there's no reason for JavaScript to know what's in the cookie. And relatively recently, web browsers added a flag to cookies that web servers could send called HTTP only. And this says, send the cookie over HTTP when the browser's communicating directly with the web server, but the browser shouldn't give the cookie away to the JavaScript, shouldn't give it to the website except directly to the server. So if we do this to all our cookies, that technique won't work before because, yeah, we'll fetch something from evil.com maybe, but it's not going to contain the cookie, it's just going to contain nothing because this cookie is not available to JavaScript. So this it gets rid of the most obvious ways of exploiting cross-site scripting, but it doesn't actually really solve much because, as it turns out, we can do more things with JavaScript, as we'll talk about next time.